Welcome to the REI Mastermind Network, where host Jack Haas gathers amazing stories from leaders in real estate investing. In each episode, our guests will tell you what they're doing that works, what they've tried that failed, and best of all, you'll learn actionable steps to take your real estate investing to the next level. Now, here's Jack with another value-packed episode.
We have Doug Howarth with me here today, and you can learn what he is up to by going to hypernomics.com, and that's going to be a clickable link in the show notes. But really appreciate your time, Doug, as we talk about your form of economics, if you will. And this is going to be really interesting. I've been looking forward to this conversation. Again, it's hypernomics.com. So, Doug, if you don't mind me starting things off, is could you kind of break things down a little bit for everybody as to what you mean by hypernomics?
Yeah, hypernomics means it's a prefix and a suffix. So the prefix is hyper, and one of the definitions of hyper means existing in more than three dimensions, like hyperspace. And then nomics comes from nonomy, N-O-M-Y, meaning a field of study. And so hypernomics means a field of study that starts in four dimensions. And while it sounds complicated, its basis is really pretty simple. It basically says that when you look at the quantity of a product, say like quantity of real estate offerings versus price, there's only a few offerings that are going to be in the billions, tens of billions. And there are going to be many more that are in the hundreds of thousands and lower. And then it's also going to say on the other side of this is that the value of the real estate might be a function of the zip code, which is the wealth that's in that area, and then the square footage of the property. And so then it's all against the price. And so we're looking there at the square footage, the income, the price, and the quantity sold. That's a four-dimensional model. So what's interesting for you and everybody that's listening is that everybody that does real estate is part of this 4D system already. Everybody's been working in this since the beginning of time. I actually discovered this idea watching my wife buy a washing machine, but I've further got the idea by watching ants. Ants are really good when it comes to doing real estate, it turns out. Richard Feynman, the physicist, would routinely study ants and make discoveries about them, even though he was off doing things about quantum mechanics, for which he got the Nobel Prize. So I found myself at the end of a trailhead one day. I looked down and I watched this little ant, little reddish black ant going counterclockwise in a counterclockwise fashion, goes about 360 degrees and he's out a little bit further than he started. And he does another 360 degree circle. And he's a little further out still and he does another one. What I realized is this little guy's doing surveillance. So I went back, raced back home and typed in ant surveillance into my research bar. And it turns out that ants do research on real estate, their real estate, where they're going to put up their new nest, much like people do the same kind of thing. The ants want to be away from other people. So people like to have space. The ants like to have space. And the ants actually try to weigh out a region that's going to be close to water, but not get underneath the water. So out here in California right now, we're having big floods. The ants would want to make sure that they're in an area that wouldn't get flooded out, but still has access to the water. Then they want to have an area that's not too high, not too low, so they can get themselves into it. And that really is what people have been doing. And this particular species of ants has been around for 40 million years. So I maintain that because ants are doing this kind of stuff, people have been doing this since there have been people. And so this is what we've all been doing. And the process of this study, this field of study, actually uncovers what we do. And so if you were to overprice or underprice something, this could tell you what that overpricing or underpricing might be. So there's several examples I could give if you're interested in one or two of them. You like commercial?
Yeah, I would really be interested in that, particularly with your wife shopping for the washing machine.
Huh. Yeah, this is how the idea really came about, was that we needed to get a new machine, and we went off to our local big box store and we rolled up onto these series of machines. And she said, you know, I like this machine here. She said, as she was studying this guy, she says, it's got a bigger drum than we got at home. I could put more clothes into it. And I thought, capacity versus price. That's a 2D problem. And then she said, we've only got one delicate cycle at home. A lot of these newer models have more delicate cycles and more cycles overall. She says, I like that. And then I thought, cycles versus price. She's up to a 3D problem. She's going to use the cycles and the capacity to help figure out what the price ought to be. And then we saw the next machine up the line. I kind of liked it. And I looked at this one. I said, what about this one? And she says, it's too expensive. We can't afford it. And what I realized was that we were part of a group of people that were going to buy this machine, the one that we were sitting at. We were pushing the quantity total out for the year. And that was quantity versus price. And people all over the washing machine area were making different decisions. And fewer people were going to buy the more expensive machines. And more people were going to buy our machine. And still more people were going to buy the machines that were less expensive than that. And so I realized that we were part of the quantity problem too. So she was working out cycles, capacity, price, and we were part of the quantity thing all at the same time. And so it works the same way in real estate, is that you could buy, and I've been listening to your show, you could buy a large apartment complex with, you know, 50 units in it, or you could buy five places that have 10 units apiece, or 10 places that have 5 units apiece. And there's a way of breaking that stuff down, depending on where the zip code is, that works out the demand for that. And that's part of what we try to do here, is work out what the prices ought to be for the properties that you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. So would it be fair, maybe I'm simplifying this to a certain extent, but it almost sounds like, especially your wife and you were looking for a washing machine, It's the perceived value associated with that in the end drives the price.
That's exactly right, Jack. And it turns out that everybody all over the world collectively sees things virtually the same way. There's variations. That's why the people vary on what they think the price ought to be. Some price the things too high, some price it too low. But in the aggregate, people feel a certain way. And that's what allows the system to work, is that people basically think the same way, and they will value the real estate much the same way going up the scale or down the scale. And that's what allows us to have this to be useful and lets people use it for their own purposes here.
Would you say then that there are some companies that seem to be a little bit more better suited or have better experience playing into this than others? I Apple comes to mind. You know,
Apple's got a real good sense of that. What they do is they've got the Apple experience. So you're not only getting the machine, you know, the machine, if you look at the machine specs for an Apple computer relative to a PC, the specs, if they're similar, the Apple computer will sell for more. Well, part of what that is the Apple computer has made itself integrate into everybody's life, it integrates with your tablets, your phones, your whole household, if you want to, much more easily than the PC products do. And so part of that whole Apple shtick is to get into the right zone. And then when you think of other industries, for example, electric cars, Elon Musk, in addition to, you know, basically making the electric car market really take off, he was very good at finding the open spaces in the market, much like those ants were trying to do, and people are trying to do too. When they get a piece of real estate, you'd like, if you have enough money, to be separated from people so you don't have to put up with the noise. You'd like to have a little bit of separation. You probably want to be close to town too, but if you had your best possible piece of real estate, you'd be away from the noise and close to the people. And what Elon Musk did in his analysis, when he came through after he made the Model S and he made the X and the Y, he put those in regions that hadn't been populated fully by the market. And so the market moved to putting the other models into the mix in a big way and became some of the most popular cars in the United States.
So getting back to the real estate side of things, you know, one of the big things that we do is we buy a lot of houses. Mm-hmm. From distressed sellers in a variety of ways. And it's the conversations kind of can unravel and they go down in a variety of different ways. But in the end, what we are trying to do is show or let the individual come to the right decision that there's value in the service we provide versus trying to sell it to on the MLS or having to go through the hassle of doing any kind of necessary repairs and the like. Have you run into companies like this that are trying to leverage hypernomics to make that part of their business better?
Well, we've been mostly in, to answer your question, Jack, we've done it for real estate, but most of our work to date's been in aerospace because we kind of came out of aerospace. I was 31 years at Lockheed Martin Skunk Works, so I had some aerospace connections. But to your point, when you talk about distressed properties, we wanted to find a shining example in real estate of a property that was distressed that somebody didn't pay attention to the market signal. So if your listeners were to go off and look up Stone Mansion in Alpine, New Jersey. This was a very large house, 30,000 square feet, that was listed originally in 2010 for $68 million. Now, it was a fabulous house. It had, the 30,000 square feet. It had lots of bedrooms, swimming pool, tennis courts, big motor court, the whole thing. Our analysis suggested it was worth about $25.3 million. They had it on the market for $68 million. So a bunch of years passed, about eight, and then they finally dropped their price to $39.3 million, and the house still didn't sell. And then finally, last year, they sold it for about $27 million, which with inflation is pretty close to what we predicted 10 years ago. So this house is on the market for 12 years. Paying property taxes. Nobody was in it, paying property taxes, maintenance, the whole bit, because this person had overvalued the property by over 2x. And had they listened to some outfit like yours, and that had said would coach them to the right price, they could have relieved themselves of having to carry that overhead for over a decade, but they didn't do that.
So what type of markers did you analyze that they were missing? I mean, these markers had to have been huge. That's a third of the value.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Well, the markers are, it's much like what you do right now, except we put a little bit of math behind it, which is you look at the comps for the nearby houses. Now, we didn't have the things that actually sold, so we took a little bit of a shortcut. We took the Zillow prices, the Zillow estimates of what the houses were worth. They're usually pretty close. I mean, your results will vary if you get the right numbers, the actual numbers for which they sold. But if you take the numbers for which the prices at which these other competing houses had sold, you would have seen that there's a certain amount of dollars per square foot that was being involved and a certain amount of dollars for the acreage. In this case, I think it was bedrooms. There were people who were paying so much for a bedroom in this place because the bedrooms are big. And you would have seen that the general market was doing this. It was going up at a certain slope. And then there was this stone mansion that was over twice what the market would bear for it as their starting price. They're about 2.5 times what the market would bear. And so what they hadn't done is they hadn't done a detailed analysis of what the comparable prices were. And so they ended up suffering greatly. I mean, again, holding the property for a dozen years because they didn't understand that. The same stuff can happen in commercial real estate too. In London, there's a big building that's put up. It's the tallest building in London right now. It's called The Shard. It's a big office building. It wanted to be a financial, it is a financial institution in London. And they put it up. And after a year, 90%, year after it completed, 90% of the offices that they had were vacant. It took them 3 years to fill the offices because they put the prices too high. Well, the reason the prices were too high is that the Shard is on, as you would say, the wrong side of the river. It's on the wrong side. It's the wrong side of the, instead of being on the wrong side of the tracks, it's on the wrong side of the river. So in London, the financial district is north of the River Thames. And this building, the Shard was south and very much west of where the rest of the financial district was. It was south of the river and west of it. So it wasn't really in the financial center. So what they didn't understand, there was going to be a drop in the perceived value of the building because they didn't get it close to where all the other buildings were of that type. So it works out that people are weighing out these features, much like my wife was weighing out the capacity versus the cycles in the washing machine. People are doing the same thing in these buildings. They're weighing out the square footage, the acreage, if you've got a house, the newness of it, the condition of it. People are weighing these things out in ways in which you can refine the price and then put the best price up so that you don't give away money on the sale, but you don't hold the property for forever either. You want to get it, if you can, it's just as close to being right as possible.
So you have a book associated with this as well. Is that's correct? And
yeah.
I found it on Amazon.
Yeah, it's this book here. It's titled Hypernomics, Using Hidden Dimensions to Solve Unseen Problems. And it just came out last week. It's available in some bookstores right now. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble and Wiley's site. And this walks you through the processes that it takes to actually create these environments for yourself so you can see them. And as I said, it turns out that everybody's using them. It just is something that had been, quite literally, as the title implies, it had been hidden from view for all these years because nobody had taken the time to figure out that basically people self-aggregate their behaviors in ways in which you can describe them. And when you figure out that what that nature of this aggregation is, then you can figure out what things are worth, including your houses.
So just to remind everybody, you can learn a little bit more about what Doug is up to by going to hypernomics.com. That is going to be a clickable link in the show notes. If you found some value in what we're talking about so far, share this with one of your investor friends. And if you're watching this on YouTube, we always appreciate a like and a subscription on this channel. So Doug, going back to the book, I believe you actually show some of the models that you're talking about associated with this. Are there any models that are defined in the book that somebody could apply to their business?
Yeah, there's some models there of the electric car market, planes. I allude to the stock market. We actually pick stocks using the software that we invented. We have the world's first 4D software for which we got a patent. And what we do with that software is we can create 4D models. This is a 4D model that was built on a 3D printer. And this is a model of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, is the Dow 30 in 2019. So in this red zone here, what we do is we take the 30 stocks that are associated with that, and each dot represents the volume, the number of shares traded that day, and the price of those stocks. And this black line that runs through these uppermost points here, that's what we call a demand frontier. This is a limit that the market imposes on itself. And so getting back to that story about Alpine, New Jersey, there was a demand frontier for houses in Alpine, New Jersey, and the Stone Mansion people wanted to be way above it, and the market simply won't allow that. And then over here on this side, this is what we call the value space. And what we do is we're looking at, in the case of the stocks, we're looking at the earnings per share on this axis, and then the return on assets on this axis. And so when you take the average of those things, the mean, you come up with a plane that describes the best representation of these bunch of points. And this tells you that stocks above this point, above this plane, may be overpriced, or there may be other features involved. And stocks below this may be underpriced, or there may be other features. And so we use this every day in our stock market analysis. This is how we have, up until, let's see, a week ago, we are doing 1.75x what the S&P 500 is doing over 47 months. So it does work for the stock market. It's been proven to work in the real estate market. And it would work for you if you wanted to apply it. What we like to think is that the advantage you give somebody is pretty good over somebody that doesn't have it. If you're somebody that has it in your pocket, you'll know when you're going into a real estate negotiation, you'll know more about the property and the value of it than your person across the table might know. And you can make stronger arguments in your behalf if you know the features that determine the value of your property compared better than your competition does. So it's a little bit like comps. People do comps in their head, and they're usually pretty good. But when you go back to this, you know, the Stone Mansion people or the people that put up the Shard in London, they got it way off. And so it's never a slam dunk that everybody knows exactly what the number ought to be. In the group aggregate, they do know what it ought to be, but some people are outside the norm and they basically said, well, we want to do this. And they think, well, there's somebody in the world that's going to want this property for this, when most of the people in the world think the property ought to be worth that. And so that's what we're trying to get to, is what's the best number for that to be property to property. And this is the kind of thing you could do on an ongoing basis. You could gather all the data together for your city or your county or wherever your area of interest is. And you could run it through a model that you could create, and you could figure out the best properties into which to invest using this. Now, some of your people also do commercial real estate too, right? So There's another factor that you can throw in there besides the square footage and say the income in a region. We did a little study of the square footage and the income in Los Angeles. And then we added in a factor which is very big out here in congested urban area like Los Angeles, just to the south of me, or New York City. It's called the walkability score. And basically that means is how easy is it for somebody that would go into a property to walk to all the services they need, the drugstore, the barbershop, the dry cleaners, the grocery store. And so this company came up with a walkability score that ranges from zip code to zip code and address to address that goes from 0 to 100, 0 being the poorest, 100 being the best. And it works out that if you were to take properties in LA, you take a 10,000 square foot commercial property and you drop it in an area that has a household income of 100,000. So 10,000 square feet and a household income of 100,000, there's going to be a series of buildings that are going to be varying sizes of square feet and have varying levels of income around that. But it turns out that there's going to be a response service, much like I showed you right there, that suggests that the value of the property is a function of the square footage and the income, but it's also a function of how easy it is to walk. And so if your walkability score here in LA at the time we studied, if it went from 45 to 90, is if that walkability doubled, the price of the real estate would just a little bit more than double. It would actually go up by 2x. And so if you're coming in and investing in, say, LA, and you want to put up a new structure, and you've got two locations that are roughly the same price to you, but one has a higher walkability score than the other one, well, barring other things like, you know, maybe there's been a lawsuit against the property or something like that, or there's a gas leak in the area that they can't fix or whatever else. But after you do all that kind of study, the place that's got the better walkability score will be worth more. And that's kind of what one of the other kind of features you can drive out of this so that you can get yourself the best possible deal more often. That's what you're trying to do here. It's never going to be foolproof either. I mean, we've been in the stock market, we've taken a few losses, but you know, when we on average beat the S&P 500, we say to ourselves, oh, it looks like it's working pretty well. And that's
The only other group of people that I know are probably pulling the level of returns you are is political people.
We like to do this without you don't have any inside information. We're just, you know,
right.
We're what's known as right now, we're known as retail investors. I mean, this fund is my fund. It's not yet open to the public. We hope eventually to pair up with a firm or two to make it open to the public. But we did this as a proof of concept. So what we did was we don't go into this or any other market willy-nilly. We did a bunch of back testing like we did with real estate. We did back tests to prove that the techniques would work, and you kind of refine it. When you got a boo-boo, you made some corrections. And we finally came up with a series of methodologies that work to tell us what to buy and what to sell. And that has worked pretty well for nearly 4 years. We'll have our 4-year anniversary in 2 weeks. So we're pretty excited about it.
Yeah. So I went to your website, and this is part of the software is part of the service. And I got to admit, I mean, your subscription rates here are reasonable. Like,
yeah, yeah, we're trying to make it something that we're trying to get this into. We're trying to get hypernomics into university, and what we want to do is we want to get what are now university business majors and econ majors. I had a degree in economics. Part of the reason I got into this is I never fully believed the law of supply and demand. And this book explains the law of value demand. And the law of value demand basically, it's only got 13 words to it or so. So it says that product features drive value. Value determines price. Price limits quantity sold. Quantity sold is a feature. So it turns out that with that little bit of knowledge, you can, as I did here, you can derive a whole book. And what we hope to do is to drive this into university. We want the price to be low for the software so we can get lots of people to be on board with this. And we think what will happen over time is that the number of errors that people make in the economy will start to fall. There's a Harvard professor named Clayton Christensen that said that 95% of all new product ideas fail. Well, that's pretty tragic. And what would happen if instead of that being 95%, that went to 94%? Well, that doesn't sound like much, but the other way to look at that is you went from 5% success to 6% success. And so the success rate might grow by 20%. Well, we think that if more people start to apply this more often to the products that they're looking at, that they'll succeed more often. And that way people won't basically take money and light it on fire as often as they do right now.
Well, would you be able to give us an example of somebody you maybe consulted with or using your software to buy a piece of real estate and the results?
No, we haven't done that for any real estate investors that we could talk to you about. That would all be proprietary right now. I can tell you about something that we called a business that we called out, though, that same idea with respect to aerospace. You'd be interested in hearing that?
Yeah, you bet.
There was an outfit in Reno, Nevada called Aireon, founded by Robert Bass, one of the Bass brothers out of Houston, is a billionaire there. And he decided he was going to build a supersonic business jet. And he went out and, you know, put billions of dollars into it. And by our measure, he got the development cost of it right. And his price was right at $120 million. It was actually a bargain. But that demand frontier I was showing you there, he was trying to go way beyond the demand frontier. He was trying to build 300 of these in 10 years when our analytics said you might build 50 when he started. And then 5 years later, you might have built 70. And he was trying to sell 300. So when he started with 20 orders in 2014 and had the same 20 orders 5 years later, I basically called him out on LinkedIn. About a week went by and I got a nasty letter from somebody from the company said, well, we just got this big order. You're all wet. And they didn't tell us, didn't make a point of the fact that all the order was what they call an optional order, which means if you build it and it flies, I'll buy it. They're not going to guarantee it. And long story short, that order was way short of what they needed. They might have been up to as many as 90 airplanes, but probably not. I said, well, good luck to you. You're going to, you know, it's not going to make it. And then 6 months later, they folded. So that's a real firm example of what happened using this. Another firm example is that it doesn't have to be as big as a $1 billion enterprise. There's a restaurant we go to down the street that when COVID hit, they had to take everybody that was indoors here. This is near Los Angeles, and people had to be seated outdoors. And so we're sitting out by heaters, and it's a very popular place. So it had pretty good capacity for most people during most times. You could only have it only occasionally where there'd be people stacked out the door ready to get in. But once COVID hit, people would be stacked out the door. And so I pulled the manager aside and I said, Kayla, would you like to make some more money at this place? And she said, sure. What do I need to do? I said, well, my observation to your place is that most of your customers come here in ones or twos, but yet you've got a bunch of tables for four and six. It turns out if you do some studies that there are more than twice as many parties of two as there are parties of four, and still more than parties of six. I said, what you need to do, you need to take out some of the tables of six and some of the tables of four and push in tables of two. And she did that. And in 2 months, the revenue shot up 25%. So it's real. It's been proven in various capacities. And, you know, we're excited for it, for not just ourselves, of course, but we think the world would be better off once people understand this. People make fewer and fewer economic errors. Governments will tend to understand that they have limits and that they won't try to exceed the limits that they have. They'll understand that there's options that they need to trade all the time. And using these kind of techniques helps them figure out their options better.
Well, I'm about to possibly go down a completely new rabbit hole.
Sure.
With all of this, and I know you have an economics background, but
yes,
how did this come from Lockheed Martin? I mean, your aerospace background, what were you doing there, and what led to all of this?
Well, I actually quit Lockheed Martin to come up with this idea, but the one thing Lockheed taught me was that programs would fail and I wouldn't know why. And so that was kind of floating around about the back of my head. I quit Lockheed and I noticed programs failed. And the other thing I did at Lockheed, I did a parametric analysis, and parametric analysis applies, you know, a few dots and tries to figure out what the cost of things are. And I got to thinking, well, the costs are probably right sometimes, but what else is going on? So what we like to do in hypernomics is we like to separate the cost, what actually costs the manufacturer to produce something, from the value, which is the what we call the sustainable price of our product, from the demand of the product. And it turns out that when you separate these things in four dimensions, then you can actually see what's going on. So I came up with this after I left Lockheed to be able to push forward these ideas.
Well, Doug, this has been a fantastic conversation, and we could continue to go down various rabbit holes, I have a feeling. But sure. If you would like to learn more about hypernomics, head over to hypernomics.com. That's going to be a clickable link in the show notes. But before I let you go, Doug, I do have a list of rapid-fire questions that we can close things out with.
Right.
Well, I'm going to change this first one a little bit. Mm-hmm. What lie do business owners tell themselves and sometimes to others?
That they've got the price right and that it'll always be the right price. That originally starts with homeowners. People always thought that the price was right of their house and that home prices would always go up. That wasn't true. We saw that 2007-08 when the housing market crashed. So people like to tell themselves that the prices will always go up for their favorite commodity. That's not always true.
Sure. Do you have a book recommendation, or what are you reading right now?
Well, besides my own book, which I recommend highly, I liked David Goggins' book, Can't Hurt Me. It showed me the value of persistence in somebody that had a pretty beaten down childhood. And I found that tremendously inspiring. He has a quote in it. He says, "Don't stop when you're tired. Stop when you're done." I like that.
Yeah, that is good. If you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that be?
Don't buy that house in 1988 that you did when I got caught up in the run-up of the housing market back in the late 80s. And so I bought a house in the late 80s, only to find the price fall off, I think 30, maybe even 40% after I bought it. And so I held on to it for 13 years. And by the time that was all done, I pocketed a neat $80 from that. That's also part of the driving force. I'm trying to figure out, what did I do wrong? I just didn't bother to take the time to break down the problem in the way in which it can be broken down now. So I'd like to tell myself not to do that when I did that. That would have been great.
Sure. What single strategy, process, or tool have you implemented that has a direct time-saving impact on your business?
Well, we use this tool that it used to be called Me4D. It's now called Hypernomica. If you go onto our website, you'll see the software. We use the software for every project that we analyze. It works out the value of a product very quickly. It basically gives you multiple views of the same set of data, and then you can keep changing things interactively very quickly. And it also shows you the demand for the product at the same time. And then if you hit the right tab, it'll assemble a 4D model for you, which the software explains to you, and it tells you if things are rightly priced, wrongly priced, and what you can do as a seller or a buyer or a new market entrant to use that data. So we use it for the stock market. You could use it if you're going to enter a new field, like Elon Musk effectively does this intuitively. People like you and me might need to have this tool in our pocket so that we could have a better fix on what to do.
Well, Doug, is there a question or concept you wish we would have covered here today?
No, I think you've hit it pretty much on the head here, Jack. I mean, this is a new field. Like, I don't want to overwhelm the audience with a whole bunch of information. I mean, the book goes into great depth on this, but I guess the question what you might want to ask is what's your long-term assessment for what hypernomics can do? I think hypernomics is going to change the world. I think it's going to dampen the spikes that we see in the stock market. It'll probably take 5 to 10 years as this gets into more widely circulated hands. But people get too, I guess the phrase is irrationally exuberant. They run prices up. You see this in housing too. They run the prices up and everybody panics and they run the prices down. So what I'd like to see happen, this would have been the good question, is, Doug, what do you feel about panics? And I said, you know, I can see a lot of people like to enjoy their panics, but I've actually done the analytics and I don't think there's any time to panic right now. I'm just going to hold on to what I've got because I know that you're overreacting. The market, you're reacting in this way and the market says you ought to react this way. So we don't sell when at the first sign of a downturn. We don't buy at the first sign of an upturn. We try to modulate what it is that we do based on good information. And I think as we go forward in time, if this starts to get ubiquitous, and we hope it does, people will make fewer decisions irrationally and more decisions based with some information that starts to dampen the wide swings that we see in the markets. Housing, stocks, everything else, they all have this volatility to them that can be dampened with better reasoning and better statistics.
Well, again, it is hypernomics.com. That's going to be a clickable link in the show notes. Excuse me there, Doug. But thanks again, Doug. This was a great conversation. I really appreciate you giving me that time.
Thank you so much, Jack. I really appreciate you and your show, and you've been doing great with it. So continue good success on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have you learned at least one actionable step to incorporate into your real estate investing? If so, please consider returning some of that value by leaving a positive review, subscribing to our YouTube channel, or joining our growing network on Facebook and Twitter. You can find links to all of our social media accounts in the show notes. See you next time.